From Culture to Church, Reflections on Jan Schiff's Sojourner in the Promised Land. I guess there's the other part of that title, which is, there you go, Life is...
40 years.
40 years among the Mormons. The editor of the New Encyclopedia of the American West, Howard R. Lamar, described Jan Schiff's Sojourner in the Promised Land as a personal and professional narrative of her lifelong career as a student of Mormonism. Our presenter's remarks today, during this session, will also be appropriately both personal and professional. In their analysis and their discussion of Jan Schiff's musings on Mormonism, more than musings, analysis, professional analysis of Mormonism, and their response to it as scholars and as the thoughtful Mormons that I know them personally to be. Our presenters are Stacy Burton, who is Associate Professor of English at the University of Nevada, Reno, and the book review editor for Dialogue. One of Stacy's, just as a side note, one of Stacy's professional interests is travel literature. So I think that this will give her, or gives her, an interesting perspective on Jan Schiff's role as sojourner and fellow traveler with the Mormons, as she's been so often described. Our other presenter is Rebecca Chandler, who teaches at the Laurel School in Shaker Heights, Ohio, and is co-editor of Dialogue. I'm assuming that they planned their remarks in such a way that they will both speak, and then we will have time. I'll have time for questions afterwards. Okay, and I'll let you just moderate the questions.
Okay.
Rather
we
than
can
stand
do that.
Again. Okay. And if you'd like to sit down, just moderate the questions. You can move the mic and come down.
Okay. Trying to get this one. Thank you, Lori. Jan Schiff, in the introduction to this collection, describes this as a collection of essays in which she blurs genres. She points out that she decided to draw upon a number of materials that had been published in a variety of places, and to make this a volume of collected essays. And in doing that, she then organized them into topical sections. In the first part of the book, though, can someone shut that door? Because it sounds like the hotel's falling apart. My train of thought is too. Thank you. She says at the beginning of the essay, in the opening essay, the prologue, that she decided to think about her years as a scholar working on Mormonism as someone who was something of an itinerant in a world not my own. She began then to write reflective essays, and the book is organized in this way, that it has five sections that include essays from her scholarly career, each of them framed by essays that are somewhat autobiographical, in which she discusses her changing understanding of Mormonism over her 40 years as a scholar. In that prologue, then, she describes it, as I said, as a collection of blurring genres. She said, "I had been thinking of a typical retrospective collection, but this was turning into something that does not fit into that conventional academic genre. Instead, I was blurring genres by encircling my articles, essays, and book chapters with a sort of reportage and reminiscence that, in earlier days, those of the many journalists and other observers who concentrated on the foreground, on particular Mormon people they met, places they visited where saints resided, and their interactions with members of the LDS community. In nearly all such writing, Mormonism itself is treated as static, as a panoramic religious background as fixed in structure and belief as most people seem to think medieval Roman Catholicism was. Almost as soon as I began describing my life among the Mormons, I started recognizing the extent to which Mormonism is not now and has never been a fixed tableau. Any proper recounting of what has happened to me during the past 40 years necessarily requires a description of what, for the same four decades, has been happening in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the dynamic religious system of which it is the main institutional expression." Shipps frames her collection, at least figuratively, as a traveler's story. And I want to detour for a minute, as Laurie anticipated, and talk a little bit about travelers and the kinds of books they write. Travelers and the books they write have long been a source of both fascination and anxiety. Especially in the 20th century, travelers are people who long to be travelers, not tourists. That's a recurring distinction in the travel narratives of the 20th century. They want to experience the people and the place truly and not merely in their most cliched forms. They want to see what is unfamiliar to them, not only the primitive, but also the modern, to see other places and peoples, not just as a distant spectacle, but also as something to be understood. Travelers in the books they write have been a source of fascination and anxiety to the people among whom they travel. People among whom they travel have wanted to be understood, but they have been anxious at the traveler's presumption to know them better, or at least differently than they know themselves. I was talking to someone recently who mentioned her great anxiety whenever any group of which she was a part was represented, because she, chances are, it would be represented in a way that would be uncomfortable to her. Since Marco Polo, readers have been curious to know the inside story and have been eager to read the tales that travelers write, from the traveler who is an eyewitness and a participant observer, and therefore seen as a source of true information. At the same time, since Marco Polo, travelers have been seen with suspicion as tellers of tall tales and liars. If you're the only one who's been there, you can pretty much say whatever you want. Jan Shipps' book is a book that deals with many different things, but one of them is a book about how to ask questions, and to ask some more questions and to ask them differently. Shipps makes a point early on and in sections where she thinks about her work as a professor that asking the right questions and asking sufficiently complicated questions is the only way to get to meaningful answers. And as someone who recites this same litany to her students every semester, I like this part of the book very much. She mentions how, as a historian and a religious studies scholar, finding answers to one set of questions simply led to the posing of other queries, which, when answered, generated even more inquiries. And she talks about figuring out the right ways to ask questions. She describes being a teacher and finding how to help students ask the right kinds of questions, ask productive questions and rich questions about their culture and about American and Mormon history. She describes the ways that Mormons historically have asked questions about themselves and the ways in which their own historiography has been productive and the ways in which it has not. All this leads her to a central question, and she describes this with a great anecdote that puts it more pointedly than it's usually put. This is in an introductory essay where she talks about often being asked to explain Mormons to national media. And she tells this anecdote. I remember very well how the voice of one reporter coming across the telephone wire expressed both exasperation and astonishment. How, he wailed, can perfectly sane people believe all this crazy stuff? That, it seems to me, is the central question that Shipps is interested in this book and in her most recent work. It is a question that has perplexed Mormon insiders, Mormon outsiders, Mormon middle-of-the-roaders, and Mormon roadkill for a long time. This leads to what, in my view, are this book's most compelling contributions. They're questions that I would see as cultural studies kinds of questions about Mormon identities and how they work in an era of profound transition. And this is this period of 1960 to 2000 that she describes. Shipps describes a transition very much still in progress from ethnicity to membership. It's captured in the title of her book in progress that she plans to call Being Mormon, the Latter-day Saint since 1945. Many anecdotes and ideas come to mind when the topic of being Mormon comes up. I could just, you know, at this point, just start rambling endlessly. I'll limit myself to two. One of them is a conversation with one of my students, a student who's just finishing her master's degree in our department, who is Mormon, who came by one day to talk about the work of Terry Tempest Williams. She had been in a class, and they had a class discussion about Terry Tempest Williams' book, Refuge. The question the student had was that, she said, most of the students in the class took Terry Tempest Williams' work to be representative of Mormon culture or of a Mormon experience. She and another Mormon student in the class thought they should point out that it was not representative. This led to a class discussion about saying that they were narrow-minded because they said she wasn't representative, and they said, no, we're not being narrow-minded. We love the book. We just don't think it's representative. Discussion deteriorated, so she came by to talk to me about it. But I think that's a good question. How can one be Mormon, yet perhaps not representatively so? We talked a little bit more then about refuge. Where in refuge does an Orthodox Mormon reader stop reading? Okay? She and I were talking about this. We had different points. She thought the first time feminist theology came up, the book would have been closed. I had thought the first time champagne came up, the book would be closed. But we couldn't agree on which would be the point. It did lead to a larger question that the student was intrigued enough about that she wrote a seminar paper on and that she's still thinking about. Which experiences or whose experiences count as Mormon? What are representative Mormon experiences? Because I work as the book review editor for Dialogue, I peruse, although I don't participate in the Association for Mormon Letters email list. And it seems to me that about once a week, there is a discussion about whether something counts as Mormon literature. And that discussion always seems to devolve to the topic of, it's not advocacy for Mormonism, so it doesn't count as representing Mormons. So you see the kinds of questions I'm getting at here. Here's the second kind of anecdote that comes to my mind when I think about being Mormon. It's kind of a religious cultural studies parlor game. If you weren't Mormon, what religion would you be? I think most Mormon medievalists I know would be Catholics. They've said as much. Friends once told me about a conversation where one person said, well, if I weren't Mormon, I'd be Orthodox Jewish. The other participant in the conversation said, I'd be some kind of liberal Protestant. I know other people whose answer would be, oh, I'd be agnostic. And I know others whose answer would be, Mormonism is the true church, I'd find it anyway. So if you really want to play this game well, you have to disallow that answer in the rules at the beginning. The complex and even bizarre range of answers that this game elicits would puzzle many Mormons, I suspect, and then not puzzle many others. It astonished a colleague to whom I gave a quick intro to Mormonism because he was going to give a keynote address at a conference at BYU, and he knew almost nothing about Mormons. So I gave him a kind of Cliff Notes tour, and when I gave him that account, he said he got how complicated it was. I thought about it this way as I was thinking about this topic on my way here yesterday. When I write about Mormonism, I'm never quite sure where to use the word we, because I don't quite know where I'm part of the we and where I'm not, or where we includes all of Mormons, including me. I finally decided that I am most comfortable using we in this sentence. We don't agree what it means to be Mormon. Jan Shipp's work, however, does much to explain what this question reveals, how this might reasonably be so, and how Mormonism's internal inconsistencies and layered history and theology might make it so. And I want to point to two passages in her books that I think are productive interesting for this topic. Writing about Mormons and their changing image in American society, she says this: Mormonism over the years somehow managed to hold in suspension a great deal of internal inconsistency. Consequently, the Mormon experience has been so incredibly diverse and complex that historians can look at the record and find enough evidence to make almost any theory seem plausible. Since American public reaction over the years reflected the diversity and complexity of Mormonism, the historians who have studied it have come away with such an astonishing variety of explanations, suggested motives, and basic themes that it has proved nearly impossible to make all of them fit into a meaningful overall pattern. That's the challenge, she suggests, for scholars. let me give you the other side of that. This is in a from the epilogue, which to me is one of the most interesting parts of this book, where she sort of looks at how she sees Mormonism as having evolved in the last 40 years and what she sees as the most pressing issues in the immediate future. She says in this section of the book, "From observing and interacting with the Latter-day Saint intellectual community across the years, I have become convinced that, more than any other, it is Mark Leon's unappreciated work that gets far enough below the surface to illuminate the crucial differences in Mormonism over this period of 40 years." And she cites his Roots of Modern Mormonism, published in 1979, but based on fieldwork done earlier, in which Leon, an anthropologist, describes a community that shared symbols whose content was still open enough to permit saints to fill them with meaning and figure out how the whole fit together. Although few church members probably realized it, many of them were doing theological work, and that's why they have different answers in that parlor game I described. To explain Mormon culture in this period of transition from church, from culture to church that she describes, is powerfully to explain how diverse the culture already is, to explain the range of ways that people who identify as Mormon experience their tradition, history, and theology. Shipp's basic argument, of course, is that in the last 40 years, what was a largely a culture has increasingly become a church, and she describes that transition in social kinds of ways, in institutional ways, in theological ways, and so on. My own appreciation for Shipp's work comes in part because she helps to articulate context for part of my life experience. Shipp's describes the transition between a church culture that was large, almost very much like an ethnic culture, primarily Utah-based, to a church culture designed to, to a church institution designed to work in many different cultures, or adapted to work in many cultures. Part of the reason I find her book interesting is that neither of those models quite matches my own growing up. I did not grow up in Zion, but I also didn't grow up in the mission field. I grew up in an established stake in Oregon in the third generation of my family to be raised there. 2001 was the 100th anniversary of that stake. It was, as Shipp's notes, the first stake to be established outside the Mormon culture region. Here's another statistic that might be pertinent to more of you than that one. 2003 will be the 80th anniversary of the Los Angeles stake. Shipp's arguments thus rang true to me, but not quite true. Utah, the first time I visited, did not seem like a home I had been missing. It seemed foreign and a little bit surreal. Mormonism, on the other hand, never felt like a diaspora experience to me, because I grew up anchored in a Mormon society that had been there for quite a while. I grew up in the ward my mother grew up in, that was the ward her father grew up in. My local example, I think, helps to illustrate Shipp's larger point. As Mormonism has third and fourth and fifth generation members across the U.S. and around the globe, how will it change? How might it change? Or how will the institution work to structure things so it doesn't change? It seems to me that a big question Shipp's asks, and that her research helps me to think about, is where this tradition is going. As Mormon theology is made more streamlined, more uniform, and less ad hoc, as there's less leeway for what Leon described, where you have the broad symbol system and people can fill in the content themselves, the church might do that to serve the purposes of global expansion, but what happens to the diversity that Shipp's describes? And I'll mention to you her speculation on this point. This is again from her epilogue. "The great irony," she says, "in the story of the past and passing generation of Mormon historians, my own generation, is that as the business of reconstructing what happened in the Mormon past moved forward, the truism that Mormonism doesn't have a theology so much as it has a history has been supplanted by one of the most important products of correlation, an ever more clearly defined theology in which the content of the tradition symbol system is being filled up, clarified, and systematized. This is an ongoing process that is likely to take another generation or two. I am nevertheless convinced that in time, the Book of Mormon will, as it was in the beginning, be more significant for the faith than the Joseph Smith story, and that what goes on in the temple will be far more meaningful to future generations of church members than anything they could learn from either correlated or uncorrelated versions of their tradition's history. Shipps also, I think, hints at what might be a less systematized version, because although she focuses on systematization, individuals do tend to make their own way. And she gives, I think it's a wonderful example. She talks about being in Logan in about 1960 and going to a faculty cocktail party and gradually figuring out that everyone there who was Mormon but not active in the church would nonetheless, especially after they knew each other, and as she put it, about the second time of drinks were being poured, inevitably the topic would turn to Mormonism. And she said people there would start talking about Mormonism even though they were somewhat alienated from it. And she said, I heard the same genre of story again and again, and it now appears manifestly obvious that these were ritual occasions during which Mormons were bearing testimony to their experiences as Latter-day Saints. But they weren't, of course, the conventional testimony. Just as the bearing of testimony in sacrament meeting builds faith, so in telling their stories to each other, as much as to Tony and me, these saints were reassuring themselves that their skepticism and their strained relationships with the institutional church were justified. That's an interesting example to me of people who are telling narratives about being Mormon, but the narratives are about being Mormon in a kind of marginalized way. Last night, as I was leaving the hotel, I started thinking on one of those sort of frivolous, well, not frivolous, but sort of parodic veins of thought that only late-night conversations at Sunstone produce. And I mentioned that as sort of a qualifier at this point. I started to imagine if, in contrast to the increasingly centralized church Shipps described, or the increasingly centralized theology, we were to think about a kind of Mormonism that was, shall we say, Utah-free Mormonism. It then seemed to me that that was perhaps a utopian thought, and it could be at least non-Utah-centric Mormonism. But then I thought about how many people I know who live Mormonism in a way that is non-Utah-centric. They don't listen to General Conference. They don't go to visit Utah. They don't like Utah. But they love being Mormon, and they love the life of their local wards. I think this is a way that many Mormons live being Mormon. And Shipps' speculations got me started to thinking about that. I'm going to end by just with one last note on travelers' tales. Theodore Adorno said in an essay on Oswald Spengler that great themes prove nothing about the greatness of insight. Jan Shipps has a great theme, and I think she does, in many cases, have very great insights. Travelers often tend to claim too much for their themes and insights. Travelers are notorious for having visited once and declaiming great things. But Shipps has visited many times. She has talked to people of all stripes among the Mormons, and I would say that her claims and her insights far exceed the bounds of her frame story. Thank you.
I first became aware of Jan Shipps about almost 20 years ago now. She's a fellow Midwesterner, and actually Lori and I were organizing a group of Midwest pilgrims to get together and have one of our annual retreats in the middle of Indiana, and someone suggested that we invite Jan to come and talk to our group. And she accepted, and she came down very graciously and spent a Sunday afternoon with us, just had dinner with us, and spoke to us about her book, at that time her new book, which was called Mormonism, a New Religious Tradition. And since that time, I've always been eager to see her at Sunstone and eager to hear what she has to say. And I read her book with great interest because I know I can trust her. I know I can trust her to be fair to us. And I think she navigates that channel between being critical of us and being an apologist for us. I think she really does help us see ourselves. as the unique people that we are. What my remarks here are a shameless nostalgia for the church that she encountered when she first started studying us. Because she began studying Mormon church about the time I became aware of myself as a Mormon, and I did grow up in Utah, in Salt Lake City. And in some ways, I think I'm a good person to make these observations because my family wasn't active. My father was really angry at the church, my mother was not. But to keep family peace, she had made the kinds of compromises that families like that make. And those compromises included sending the children to Sunday school, sending the children to primary, but staying away from meetings that would cause problems with the marital partner. So my mother went to Relief Society and taught primary, and that was it. And interestingly, I have since observed probably a third of the kids I grew up with had that pattern. And the ward in the school that I attended as a child had many, many kids that had those kinds of experiences growing up as well. But what it means is that my identity as a Mormon, my Mormon legacy, is not from my family. It is not from the culture of growing up Mormon in a Mormon household as much as it is what the institutional church gave me. And looking back, it gave me a lot. I have written elsewhere about my experiences in primary, which I loved with all my heart. I remember going to primary in the middle of the afternoon. Those of you who grew up when I did will share some of these experiences, and I hope that you'll have some to share with us afterward. Those of you who didn't may wonder if I'm describing the same church you grew up in. But we went to primary on Tuesday afternoon, or in the summertime on Tuesday morning. And my church was located right next door to Longfellow School, so it was a 5-minute walk across the grass. I've talked to people from rural areas who have released time primary, and they actually got an hour out of school because every kid in the school was Mormon, and they all went to primary. But primary was a wonderful place to be. We had about an hour and a half. We had the whole building to ourselves. I remember the consecration of the women who taught us, many of whom were involved in the same kinds of households my mother was. Husbands were not active in the church. We're not going to fix that right now, are we? Their husbands weren't active in the church. They stayed away on Sundays, but they really were committed to helping the children have a good experience and have a good start. I remember being reverent in primary. That was a very good deal. We had the building all to ourselves, and it was a nice building. It had some aesthetic components that I have since missed in my liberal experience. I also remember very serious learning. I learned the Articles of Faith. I can still say them. I remember learning to knit and to crochet and to cross-stitch and kinds of things that kids aren't learning in the Sunday block schedule. Most of all, I remember the music. And if I get to thinking about that, I get teary because it really is where it all started for me, those simple little melodies that taught those simple gospel truths in ways that just hooked me. Junior Sunday school was almost a counterpart to that experience. There was a junior Sunday school room. And we don't have junior Sunday school rooms anymore. It's one of those places that gets thrown together every now and again. Yeah. And we had miniature little pews and a little pulpit just our size. In our case, they were green. I remember that. And I remember, you know, of course, giving those first talks and how scary that was. But I also remember the priesthood coming to give the sacrament to the children. And that must have been a good experience for those young men to come and provide that for the children. But it certainly made an impact on me to see that we were important enough to be ministered to by all these older people who obviously had other things to do but who chose to do this. The same music. I think the sort of transition to senior Sunday school, by the time we were baptized, we would go to join the senior Sunday school and we had to know the hymns by the time we got there. So they were very careful to teach us the hymns and make sure we were ready to take our place. And we knew that that was where we belonged. In my case, there was a neat divide between the ward of my childhood and the ward of my youth because we moved. And I joined an East Bench ward, the Yale Second Ward, just about the time I was starting Young Women, although we didn't call it then, we called it MIA. And that was about the time that Dean and Cheryl May have characterized in their studies as the beehive period. They have done an interesting study of the Sugar House Ward, where they show how you can take a ward that was characteristic of a little community that was dedicated to one particular industry and then moved as the population changes and as the town itself changed and the ward becomes a suburban ward. And this period that they write about in the late 50s and the early 60s, they just call the Beehive period because it was so busy. And because ward members, even though the ward wasn't their whole lives anymore, was still a really important part. An active member of the church might go to church 9 times in a given week. And as a young woman going to MIA, suddenly I was encouraged to go to sacrament meeting, even if my family wasn't going. So an hour and a half Sunday morning, an hour and a half Sunday afternoon, an hour and a half to MIA. The young men were going to priesthood meeting during this time. And if you got involved in activities, and there was no end of them, you could spend all kinds of extra time over there as well. We were conscious of earning individual awards. And I got competitive about that. Boy, if you could get an individual award for 75% attendance, I wanted 95%. Some years I got 100%. You just didn't miss anything because it was great. You wanted to be there, and it was a great place to be. I also participated in, and this is not inclusive, road shows, dance festivals, basketball teams, baseball teams, ward and state dances, quartet festivals, choral festivals. There was a ward one-act play, which led to a fashion show because a lot of us were working on things that we were making, and someone said, oh, look, all these young women know how to sew, so let's have a fashion show and show off what they make. Ward parties going up the canyon all the time. If my family had been active, there would have been all kinds of activities I would have participated in with them. These were just the ones available to me. Went to MIA Girls Camp in Brighton, which was 3 years of 1 week of just pure gold. Loved every minute of it. And again, the music that I remember. My sister and I still get together and sing these camp songs and have our husbands really wonder about these women that they married that haven't given up on the MIA Girls Camp songs. Remember one time all of the young women went to Sun Valley, Utah, just took the whole ward. All the young women went to Sun Valley. Had my family been active, there would have been more activities. Had I been a young man, think of all the possibilities. All the fathers and sons outings, all of the scout outings, those weren't available to me. Had I lived in the mission field, might have had the opportunity to build my own building, and didn't have that opportunity because the buildings were already built. East High School, seminary, 4 excellent years of experience. I didn't have to go to seminary. It was not the requirement that it has since become. Plenty of good, active kids didn't go to seminary because they took maybe chemistry or something else. Plenty of them grew up to go on missions and be bishops and stuff. That was fine. But I really enjoyed seminary, even though I agonized over what I had to give up in my schedule. I went and enjoyed it. I loved the individuality of the teachers that I had, and they were not standardized. They didn't have Mylar index tab lesson plans. They were allowed to be themselves, and I was lucky enough to have a couple of really outstanding seminary teachers. Still have some of the materials they gave me, still have so many of the thoughts and ideas that they gave me when I need them, and I continue to be grateful for the legacy of that experience. By the time, oh, Bonneville Strings, I should probably mention. I played the violin, and there was a gentleman in our ward who had a lot of students, organized us all into an orchestra. Mostly we played at state conference, which was quarterly conference at the time, met 4 times a year for 2 sessions, morning and afternoon. Sat literally at the feet of prophets and apostles, and we had a visiting general authority every time, and played and listened to them. By the time I got to college, Relief Society, that would take another whole session to talk about the changes in Relief Society. It was already under transformation when I started to attend, but I was there in time to be part of the lesson cycle that was 4 distinct different kinds of lessons. They were at the time very, very needy. We had theology, and we had literature, and we had social science lessons, and some kind of homemaking lesson. I don't remember what it was, but always something, and the weeks rotated. And then later they got classier names, spiritual living and cultural refinement and something else, social relations. But we still had lessons on all kinds of things. We weren't having basically a spiritual living lesson every time you went to Relief Study, which I think is what has happened since that time. We had work meetings that lasted pretty much all day long. We always had a luncheon once a month. Somebody else did the babysitting. We had our own budget. We could arrange to have every woman in the ward who was available to participate in an activity. We didn't have to have some of us out with the kids. I know we paid for that independence by having bazaars. Those were an experience, but one that I actually enjoyed when I had time to be a part of those. When the consolidated meeting schedule came along, I thought I was ready for it. I had a young family. We had moved to the mission field by then, and it was hard to pack kids into the car and make that long drive 2 or 3 times a day or several times a week. But I find that with those changes, there are so many things that I miss. And I also spent some time talking to friends saying, what do you miss about the church before this big change was made? And these are some of the things that came up again and again and again. I miss standalone sacrament meeting. I miss going to sacrament meeting at a different time of the day when actually not everybody comes. I can remember kids staying home with young teenagers and just the adults coming and maybe the kids that were having dates coming to sacrament meeting and coming at a more dignified time of the day and having just a more dignified pace to the meeting and maybe watching it get dark through the windows. Those had stained glass windows in the front of our chapels, and I really loved that. And if the speakers were boring, I still enjoyed being there. And I really miss that experience. I miss the beautiful, interesting buildings that I grew up worshiping in. I was very, very fortunate. The church in my childhood had a balcony and a spiral staircase. Very, very cool. And the L. Second Ward just had a wonderful, the windows and some wonderful sculptures, really, on the sides, and just a very appealing plan that made it a very pleasant place to be. Both of these buildings had cry rooms. And children were taken to the cry room, or they hadn't been brought to church at all. I don't remember the noisy, chaotic tone that is characteristic of my ward now. My ward has an unconscionable number of young families, and I know that we're not typical either, but it was certainly not part of my experience growing up. I miss the Salt Lake City skyline with the temple spires higher than the church office building. I miss attending conference in the tabernacle. Some of the other things I miss are less concrete, but I do miss them. The atmosphere of trust and optimism. Growing up, it was clear that this was the true church, that we had all the answers. It was just a matter of time. We would, Sarah Hamill would be found. They would convince everybody of this. It would be fine. I also felt that there was room for inquiry. I don't remember ever being shouted down for the questions that seemed to be in my nature to ask. Rolled eyes once in a while, but really, it was okay to ask questions. I miss a more open, diverse atmosphere that made room for part member families. And in my case, had that not been available to us, I would not have been a part of this whole experience, nor would so many of my friends and other family members. I miss the energy and excitement of that period. I miss hearing about free agency. Remember that? We used to hear about free agency all the time. Now we hear about follow the prophet. Want to be fair, there have been some really positive changes. And I think at the top of almost anybody's list would be the 1978 revelation. To have that issue resolved and have it resolved in the way it was such an enormous relief to all of us. I think we've made some progress incorporating young women in more positive ways. Certainly more young women are being encouraged to our missions. I think we're being more realistic about their prospects and helping them make friends. Not always, but more than we used to. Some movement toward getting along with other religions, especially the RLDS. It was fun to have lunch today at this table with members of the Community of Christ and remember when they were enemies. Those apostates were what we were told, and of course they were thinking the same thing about us. And to have us meet as friends and be respectful of each other is something that would have been hard to imagine earlier in my life. The growth of the church has led to access to wards and stakes without having to live in Utah. And my husband's family had to make a conscious choice when he was just a child not to accept a position in the Midwest because there just weren't enough church members there. And to be able to make the decisions that we've made and choose to live somewhere else in the country and know that we would still have access to a Roman ward is a great and a good thing. Less emphasis on pioneer ancestry. I think for folks who had pioneer ancestors that could tell those great stories and could kind of feel youth of the noble birthright, that was great. But for those of us who didn't, and my family didn't, it's nice to have that emphasis not quite the way it was. And I'm grateful for that. I think we have more enlightened, if not overtly stated, policies on heterosexuality and birth control than we used to. I think two-piece garments are good. I think it was nice when they said we could have slacks on the BYU campus. the standardized cost of admission seems to me to be a very fair thing to be doing. And the Perpetual Education Fund and some of the other humanitarian efforts that we are making seem to be very, very positive moves in the direction I would love to see our church be going. Some of the changes, I think, have brought mixed results. Consolidation means fewer meetings, which save time and energy. But it also, well, it can just mean less guilt if you're not attending your meetings, because there aren't as many to attend. But I think the meetings themselves are less aesthetic places to be. They're rushed and hassled and harried and crammed into, you know, you sometimes just get the feeling we're warehousing people and they're going here and here and here for a very short period of time and then racing off to something else. And they've certainly hurt community. You just don't bond with people in the hall between meetings in 5 minutes. It's greatly affected part member families and kids like me who would not be able to go all 3 hours to meetings that families weren't supporting. The correlation program probably has given us less false doctrine, more orderly pattern of indoctrination. But I kind of miss that false doctrine. It was at least entertaining. Some of our meetings are really boring now. And my concern, my biggest concern, is that we're also consolidating and correlating our members, that we are looking for a particular kind of member, and that there just isn't enough room for other approaches to living the gospel because we're being kind of told how we ought to be. Would you like me to wrap it up? Okay, one quick observation. In my state right now, there have been two events that have brought this to my awareness. The Columbus Temple was just dedicated. And they made such a very big fuss about who was permitted to attend that and who was not. And children under 10 were not permitted to go, and pregnant women were not permitted to go, and you had to get a ticket, and you had to have an interview. And they had all these restrictions, and then there were several levels of tickets. There were the people who got to be in the temple, and then there were people who were at various satellite locations. And of course, the next day, we heard from all the people who got the good tickets and got to be in the good place. And I couldn't help wondering, is this a metaphor for what I'm supposed to expect later on in my life, and I'll somehow wind up with the wrong ticket, and I'll be in the wrong place? I wasn't crazy about it. BYU is so crowded now. It's so hard for kids to get in. EFY, you've got to call the day that they let you in, because otherwise you don't get a chance. I just don't get the feeling that I had growing up, come on, you're welcome, we've got room for you, we want you to be here. Jan's observation in Washington, D.C., which is not published in this book, is that as a people, we define ourselves by something that makes us peculiar. And she sees polygamy as the first big institution that set us apart, and then the word of wisdom, and now temple worship. And on the one hand, that makes it available to anybody who wishes to bring his or her life up to that standard, but on the other hand, it screens out all of those other people who might want to be a part of full faith and fellowship. The theme in primary right now is temples. As a child, if I were attending primary, knowing that I was not born in the covenant, I think it would be a painful reminder day after day after day after day that I'm not one of the chosen kids. So, it's a different church. Things have changed a lot. I remain grateful for my legacy as a Latter-day Saint, and I'm certainly grateful to Jan for helping me understand it a little bit better, and for, I think, representing this as well as she does to the world. So, thank you. Questions or comments? I'm hoping there'll be lots. Yes, I saw you nodding. Would you like to talk into the microphone?
Yes.
Come on. Come on.
I recently, we started attending a family ward. We've been going for several years to a special needs branch in downtown Portland that serves low-income and disabled people. We started going to the family ward, and I now have the opportunity to attend church in the first building that I ever remember attending church in when I was a very little girl. And it is the most non-standard building, probably, that is still being used in the regular Mormon State Center. When I was very small, I remember there being perpetual building fund drive going on, because it got to the point where the church would no longer participate in the funding of any of the expansion products on the building. And it is huge. It has a full-size gymnasium, full-size basketball court, like regulation basketball court, and underneath the gymnasium, a banquet hall of that exact same size. It has a separate wing for the stake offices. It has a young women's room, a relief society room, a baptismal room that's separate by itself, a scout room, a junior Sunday school room with miniature pews that are still there, and the same ones that I sat on when I was a little girl. So it just has everything, and it's this wonderful building. It has stained glass in the chapel, and it has walls in the chapel that are paneled with beautiful, clear, straight grain Douglas fir paneling that's native to the Northwest. Anyway, so I'm just really thrilled that some of these things are still existing, and there have been times when the church has tried to get rid of our building, and the members won't let it happen. So there are still these things that are persisting, but a lot of them went away. And I do have some of these memories from before consolidation, which happened when I was a beehive. But I was going to primary during the week and the different meeting schedule. My younger siblings, my younger sister's 13 years younger, and has absolutely zero memory of any of that. So we have a generational gap and within our own family.
Yeah. Within 13 years.
Within 13 years.
Someone else. Can you come here?
I believe early on someone was making a point.
I'll be all for one.
There we go. Worst goes on here when I need. Early on, I think someone was making the point that there's a tremendous amount of variety.
Called The Scattering of the Gathering, where she talks about the diaspora of Mormons across the U.S. that came with economic change and increased mobility following the Second World War. And one of the things she suggests in a note to that goes right along with what you were saying, and I thought I'd just read that. She says, holding a temple recommend, which is mandatory for saints entering temples, is not a requirement of membership in the church, and certainly not for informal admission to the LDS community. But a two-tier system of sainthood is apparently developing, in which members of the church who hold temple recommends are in one category, and those who do not are in another. So,
in my ward, the bishop actually made a policy that no callings would be extended to anyone not holding a temple recommend.
So what, you're largely on staff?
Not at all. We happen to have a zillion students, and so right now the entire ward is manned by folks under 30 who are, you know, fresh out of BYU and need that qualification. But, you know, to screen out somebody not married in the temple because the husband is a non-member, or anyone who doesn't hold the temple recommend at this present moment, seems to me to be exactly what this community is not all about. Would you like to?
You know, I'd like to comment on a couple things. One thing is I joined the church when I was 20, and just down here in Alhambra Ward. And, you know, I can remember, it's amazing to me how I think that the church is becoming so professional now that it's very, you know, we're becoming so white collar and so professional that I don't see how people that are regular people like carpenters or you know, people, mechanics or anything like that are really going to be able to feel they fit in, because I think, you know, as I live out in the valley out there, and I see that, you know, more and more that the people are in sales, they're in business, they're in something where they have to have a college education, and you know that if you want to have a family, and if your wife has, it's going to be a stay-at-home mom, you have to make a heck of a lot of money. So even if you're inclined that maybe you'd like to be a carpenter because you like working with your hands, that's maybe not really an option for you. You know, that you've got to bring in the big bucks, and I think that, you know, that, you know, I think that that's why there's a lot of friction between the families and the churches, because, you know, there's, you know, to keep up with the world, and, you know, and the tremendous amount of money that it takes to do that. Also, I did want to say something about the session that I heard this morning with Arlen Moss and Dr. Smith about talking about a cookie cutter thing, you know, that in the church it's a cookie cutter thing. But, you know, if we could expand this into this, last year I've just really gotten into economics and globalization. And I've been studying that book after book after book. I've become very, very interested in that. Is that in the same way, our country feels like that we need to impose our great sacred capitalistic institutions upon any nation in the world, that if you want to deal with us, you have to do it our way. And so we're trying to make It's, you know, maybe a cookie cutter church is a reflection of the cookie cutter world that we're living in. Anyway, I joined the church and I got in on the tail end, and I still was able to participate in a lot of these things. But, you know, I did notice the big changes and everything. But it is a shame because I cookie cutter approach, I don't think is really going to be beneficial in the long run. Thank you.
Just go ahead.
Your observation about socioeconomic status is one that often concerns me. I think the demographics of activity and inactivity are so often tied to finances. There are wards in the church where 90% activity rate seems to be areas where it's very, very, very prosperous. And blue-collar areas, the activity rates go way down. And there's something wrong there. Something very wrong.
I've known you for a long time, Becky, maybe not so long, but it seems that the way the church is relevant for different, even just age groups of people changes, certainly it varies across any number of dimensions. Well, let's just address that one. How do you think the church is different for, so you're roughly half generation of me, your big kids babysat mine. So how's the church change in relevance between me, your kids, and how's it going to be for my kids? And how do you see that change?
I'm just tired of things. I lasted a really long time in Relief Society, but it's so boring now that I don't go, and I don't think it's gripping my daughters the way it did me. I enjoyed Relief Society when I was in college, and it kind of poised me to be active in that organization for the next 20 or 30 years. And they're already bored. So that's one response.
Well, there's a difference between bored and irrelevant. Maybe not.
I think the reason I'm bored is because I'm not finding it relevant to my life experience. How about you?
I think when I was a child, that one of the ways the church was very relevant was that it was a warm, welcoming community. And it was a different, you described the ways that you were welcomed there. I think for me it was so intertwined with my family and that life that's where a great deal of the connection was. As I look at, I don't have children, but as I look at my nieces and nephews and see their connection to the church, in many kinds of ways it is social, but it doesn't seem to answer questions that they have. And they have them at a younger age, I think, than I did, and I think they're bigger questions. And I think the kind of institution it's evolving into, I mean, what Schiff's describes is in some ways inevitable with growth. It's inevitable with demographic changes. It's inevitable in a society where people move more frequently and all of those sorts of things.
And where women work.
And a society where women work. I mean, the nostalgia for the church of the 50s and 60s has got to be tempered by recognizing that that was built on enormous amounts of volunteer work from women. And yet, I do think that there's something of a kind of freedom of the community, or a freedom of thought, or freedom of association that people feel they've lost, and that if the institution says we are here to answer your questions, but there's not a venue to talk about them, I think it's less relevant. I know it's certainly less central to the daily lives of my nieces and nephews than I think it was to us as children, and they're certainly as active as we were. It's just the social changes, so.
There's an antidote. It's Sunday school.
I'm never there.
Thank you very much.